Hello, and welcome to Talking with Tumors with Ryan and Ryan. I'm Ryan Holstead.
And I'm Ryan Klein. And today we're going to be talking about the latest and greatest with HER2-LO and sacituzumab govitecan. These are some hot topics. We'll be getting more into general principles of the management of HER2-positive breast cancer, but we just wanted to talk about these new recent updates because they pertain to patients with hormone-positive disease.
We appreciate everyone who's been listening to the podcast, and we also are thankful for the website feedspot.com, which lists us as one of the top oncology podcasts. Certainly, if anyone has any comments or ways that we can improve, please send us a tweet or an email.
We're recording this on December 28th, so we hope everybody had a good holiday. We have some advice for anybody traveling. We learned this weekend that you do need a passport if you're flying from the U.S. to Canada for an infant. We were not aware of that.
Apparently you can drive with just a birth certificate across the border.
Our three-month-old did surprisingly good in the car for 14 hours straight, so silver lining.
All right, so we're going to be spending the bulk of today talking about HER2-LO and the recent trial looking at trastuzumab deruxtecan in this population. I think it's worthwhile, you know, going over the process of HER2 testing first. This is going to be pertaining to our HER2 positive lectures, but it also helps give an idea of what we're talking about when we're talking about positive, low, or negative. Like hormone positivity, HER2 is seen on a continuum. This is an overexpression, not a point mutation. Pathologists have found ways of trying to quantify various levels of HER2, as cells with more HER2 are more likely to be dependent on this as its signaling molecule.
Yeah, this is a very important distinction because, as we'll see, the treatment is drastically different whether it's HER2 positive or negative. So no pressure on the pathologist, but this is an extremely important distinction because you wouldn't want to withhold HER2 therapy on somebody by accidentally calling them HER2 negative.
We mentioned this previously during our gastric cancer discussion, but the definitions of 1+, 2+, 3+ is different depending on whether this is a gastric or breast cancer. So certainly when you're dealing with metastatic disease and maybe the primary isn't completely clear, make sure to let your pathologist know what tumor you think you're dealing with so that they can give you the most accurate HER2 listing. The basis for what we consider to be positive or negative is primarily from an adjuvant trial, B47, which found a specific a percent of patients with some HER2 positivity were unable to benefit. And this kind of broke down our modern definitions of HER2 negative or HER2 positive. Since that time, as pathology techniques have gotten more complex, we've developed some expert consensus to try to better define which breast cancer is most likely to respond. Today, modern testing uses immunohistochemistry, or IHC, as well as in situ hybridization, or ISH, for confirmation in some indeterminate findings. So the most important and kind of primary part of testing is going to be your IHC. This is given as a 0, 1 plus, 2 plus, 3 plus score. If the IHC comes back as 0 or 1 plus, this is HER2 negative. If the IHC comes back as 3 plus, this is HER2 positive. Where things get a bit more messy and require a bit more workup is when the HER2 comes back as 2 plus. This is considered equivocal. And when it is equivocal, that's when we follow up with our in situ hybridization. ISH is going to be given out as a copy number. The numbers to be aware of for this are either greater than 6 or less than 4. If your HER2 is 2+ and your ISH has a copy number greater than 6, this is a positive test. Likewise, if your HER2 is 2+ and your ISH is less than 4, this is a negative test. You may note that once again, there's an indeterminate range because for some reason, this is one of the most complicated pathology protocols around. And if you're between that 4 to 6 number, you then follow up with what's called a dual probe ISH. So basically doing an ISH testing against HER2 as well as another protein called CEP17. Because we're looking at two proteins, now we're going to actually have something called a ratio. So we first had IHC, then we had copy number, and now we're looking at ratio. And in the case of ratio, the numbers that matter are greater than 2 or less than 2. And if the ratio is greater than 2 and your copy number was greater than 4, this is a positive test. If your ratio is less than 2 and your copy number is less than 4, this is a negative test. Very rarely, although potentially a high yield question, would be as if your copy number and ratio are discordant. So you have a ratio greater than 2 and a copy number less than 6, or a ratio less than 2 and a copy number greater than 6. If this happens, you actually get a second opinion. You have a second pathologist who's blinded to the first pathologist who then goes through this whole same process. If they find the same findings, we defer to the copy number. So for copy numbers less than 6, this is negative. For greater than 6, this is positive. And if the second opinion disagrees with the first opinion, our guideline colleagues recommend institutional adjudication, which basically means each place will decide how they want to proceed. So most of the time you're going to have a very clear picture. It's either going to be 0, 1 plus, or 3 plus. If it's 2 plus, you're then going to go to copy number. Remember, greater than 6 is positive, less than 4 is negative. In the middle, we then do for ratio greater than 2 and copy number greater than 4 is positive, less than 2, less than 4 is negative. And then the secondary opinion as discussed previously. Highly recommend looking at figures, especially maybe a week or two prior to your respective board testing.
Yeah, it's important to know that the IHC can be somewhat subjective. 3 plus is defined as complete and intense circumferential staining within greater than 10% of tumor cells. 2 plus is considered weak or moderate circumferential membrane staining in 10% of tumor cells. And 1 plus is faint or barely perceptible. So although this may sound somewhat straightforward, it can be subjective, which is why they usually, in cases that are indeterminate, we'll have several pathologists review them. The FISH tends to be less subjective and a kind of more objective measure.
That being said, there are multiple different FISH testing kits out there, and not all have the same validation process. Certainly good if you're in doubt, and you're especially if you're working in a community center, to get that second opinion from a larger referral-based pathologist. So these HER2 drugs that we're going to be talking about are very effective, and we don't want to deny our patients that if they're a potential candidate for them.
HER2 low became relevant in the era of antibody drug conjugates, such as T-DXd, which is trastuzumab deruxtecan, which was the drug that was recently used in the DESTINY-Breast04 trial, which we'll get to. Previously, HER2 status was considered binary, either positive or negative. But since these HER2 drugs are extremely effective, there was investigation to see, can we apply this to more patients?
So the definition of HER2 positive or negative, as we mentioned, was based upon whether or not something's sensitive to trastuzumab. Now, this inhibits these cells, preventing them from growing. And cells that are not fully dependent on HER2, well, don't necessarily care if those receptors are inhibited. With the advent of the antibody drug conjugates, we're using the HER2 more as an anchor to deposit chemotherapy rather than actually inhibiting the protein itself. And that led to the trial which we're about to discuss, where we looked at patients who were not historically relevant to trastuzumab, but seeing whether or not using one of these antibody drug conjugates to target chemotherapy on HER2 expressing cells would be beneficial. We've discussed antibody drug conjugates before, but just briefly, these are typically monoclonal antibodies that are bound to a chemotherapy. Often these chemotherapies are historically very toxic chemotherapies that were unable to be given systemically. But the thought is by anchoring them to an antibody, we're having a focused dose of these chemotherapies near to our tumor. Understandably, this isn't perfect. Sometimes these antibodies will bind to similar appearing receptors. Non-cancer cells may express the same receptors. And there's also the potential that the antibody and drug can just detach in circulation. So we're not completely avoiding systemic chemotherapy, but certainly with a way of better targeting.
One of the more relevant antibody drug conjugates that is getting a lot of press these days is trastuzumab deruxtecan. This is an antibody to HER2 combined with deruxtecan, which is a topoisomerase 1 payload. You'll hear the word payload being used in these antibody drug conjugates, which is just the chemotherapy that's attached to the antibody. So the study looking at this, the DESTINY-Breast04 trial, which was published in the New England Journal this year, so the phase 3 trial looking at patients with hormone positive HER2 low, which they define as either IHC 1+ or IHC 2+ with a negative FISH. The primary endpoint of the study was progression-free survival in the hormone positive cohort, and this study randomized patients in a 2-to-1 manner to either trastuzumab deruxtecan versus physician's choice of chemotherapy. And they gave the choice of either capecitabine, eribulin, gemcitabine, paclitaxel, or nab-paclitaxel, which I think are all pretty reasonable options. Once patients fail endocrine therapy, as we said previously, the next treatments are typically just single-agent chemotherapies in sequence. And these are very reasonable options, I think.
It is worth mentioning that all the patients had to have had at least greater than or equal to one line of chemotherapy in the metastatic space. Although prior lines of treatment weren't discussed in the manuscript, we would assume a lot of these patients would have gotten capecitabine because that's often our go-to first chemotherapy agent.
So the study included 557 patients. 90% of them are hormone positive. So the hormone receptor negative patients were included in the trial, but were not included in the primary analysis for progression-free survival. The median prior lines of therapy was 3, so fairly heavily pretreated patients. And the groups were stratified by the IHC, or how they were considered HER2-low, either IHC 1+ or 2+ with a negative FISH. They are stratified by a number of prior lines of therapy, hormone receptor status, prior CDK4/6 inhibitor, as well as the presence of brain metastasis. The study actually did allow stable and treated brain mets.
These patients were primarily hormone positive. There were 60 patients who were triple negative.
So getting to the results, the progression-free survival in the hormone-positive group, it was 10.1 months for the T-DXd, the trastuzumab deruxtecan group, versus 5.4 months in the physician's choice chemotherapy group. If you look at the chemotherapy that was chosen, 20% of patients got capecitabine, 50% got eribulin, 10% got gemcitabine, 8% paclitaxel, and 10% nab-paclitaxel. The overall survival was 23.9 months versus 17.5 months with a hazard ratio of 0.64. So pretty significant, you know, patients that are heavily pretreated.
Yeah, I think, you know, we always look to make sure these patients are similar to what we'd see in clinic. And 70% of them had previous CDK4/6 inhibitors, which is good. You know, certainly we expect to be closer to 100%, but 70% is maybe in line with what we would see in clinical practice. And 67% had greater than or equal to 3 lines in the stage 4. So it's certainly consistent with heavily pretreated patients. It's not often we see such a large progression-free survival or even a survival benefit at this later line.
If you look at the difference between the IHC 1+ versus 2+, again, the study was not powered to look at any differences between these groups, but it was pretty similar. Progression-free survival in the trastuzumab deruxtecan group was 10.3 months in the IHC 1+ and 10.1 months in the IHC 2+. Again, not powered for this, but good to know that there wasn't really difference. Looking at the triple negative group, and again, this was only 60 patients, so you cannot take much from this. As we would expect, so the progression-free survival and overall survival was less in the triple negative group than in the hormone positive group, with a PFS of 8.5 months in the trastuzumab deruxtecan group versus 2.9 months in the physician's choice of chemo group.
So the toxicities of this drug, you know, we've gone over it in some detail previously when we talked about the later line gastric trials, but the thing to keep in mind for trastuzumab deruxtecan is the risk of pneumonitis. Interestingly, in this trial, the rates of pneumonitis were a bit lower than some of the previous studies, and this might be due to greater provider awareness and earlier recognition and treatment. Still quite a toxic medication. So looking at toxicities overall, 16% of patients with the trastuzumab deruxtecan actually discontinued therapy compared to 8% of the chemotherapy group. Primary toxicities were due to cytopenias and nausea. Looking specifically at pneumonitis, 12% of patients in the trastuzumab deruxtecan group ended up having some level of pneumonitis. 1.3% of this was grade 3. 0.8%, which was a total of 3 patients, was grade 5. During the presentation at ASCO, there was a mention of some patients having CT scans of the chest as frequently as every 2 months, although this wasn't listed in the protocol. Certainly recommend anyone who's speaking to providers who've used this drug frequently to be familiar with what their process is. And I hope we'll get some more guidance as we move forward on how to screen for pneumonitis and properly prevent it so that patients can continue on this, what seems to be a very effective therapy in later line breast cancer.
Yeah, I think that there's a reason why people are very excited about this trial. It provides an effective drug to use when you don't have many options left, but then an overall survival benefit.
A couple things just to mention here. We mentioned that this trial did have a 2-to-1 randomization. What that means is for every patient who was on the control arm, there was 2 patients on the intervention arm. This is a fairly frequent thing you'll come across with a lot of the modern trials. One of the reasons that it's done is to give patients who are deciding to enroll this trial, I thought that they have a higher chance of getting the active drug than placebo. There's a lot of commentary on whether or not this is an effective thing, and I certainly refer everyone to the plenary session, which has gone into this discussion in great detail. Another thing to mention is treatment of provider's choice, also discussed a lot on the plenary session. Always good to look, which Ryan alluded to, these are drugs that we would typically give, but it's important to take a close look at the treatment of provider's choice and make sure, is this something that I would choose for my patient if they were not able to get trastuzumab deruxtecan. It would be nice to know how many patients got capecitabine before, and certainly I'd assume that anyone who got capecitabine before were not getting it on the trial.
Just want to clarify that we're talking about the plenary session podcast with Vinay Prasad and not the plenary session because Destiny Breast 04 was presented during the plenary session of ASCO. So
yes, good point.
Separate podcast.
I've listened to that podcast so much now, it's become almost synonymous for me.
I was going to say, you just said plenary session.
Yeah, whoops. Another just kind of thing to be aware of for those of you who are still getting familiar with, you know, different trial terms and evidence. In this case, the HER2 low is a predictive marker, not a prognostic marker. HER2 low patients do just the same as HER2 negative when it comes to traditional hormone positive breast cancer. However, now we have this predictive marker that gives us an extra treatment option in our armamentarium. So predicts response to therapy, does not predict increased overall or less overall survival.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I think HER2 positive is a poor prognostic factor, but it is a good predictive factor for the anti-HER2 therapy. So before the 1990s, when trastuzumab was discovered, HER2 patients actually had a very poor prognosis, but now, since it's a positive predictive factor in response, it's actually a better prognosis.
Yeah, definitely improved prognosis for those patients to the pre-trastuzumab era. So last, briefly, just on the topic of these latest and greatest outcomes and on antibody-drug conjugates, we wanted to add in the discussion of sacituzumab govitecan. This is another later line option that's out there. It's an antibody-drug conjugate combining govitecan, so another topoisomerase inhibitor based upon the SN38, like our irinotecan. And in this case, the antibody is bound to antitrophoblastic cell surface antigen 2, which just rolls off the tongue, which is why we've shortened it to TROP2. And greater than 90% of patients with metastatic breast cancer are positive for TROP2, which led to this drug antibody conjugate being investigated in clinical trial. Very briefly, this drug has had a role in triple negative breast cancer previously. They did a trial looking at patients who had greater than two lines of chemotherapy in the metastatic space and being randomized to either this drug or treatment of physician's choice, which was also one of four chemotherapies. And in this case, they found a pretty significant improvement in progression-free survival of 5.6 versus 1.7 months, and medium overall survival is 12.1 versus 6.7 months. Primary toxicities that were ran into were related to cytopenias and diarrhea. About 30% of patients had a grade 3 or greater neutropenia.
So this was then explored in the hormone-positive, HER2-negative setting in the TROPiCS-02 trial, and this also was looking at the sacituzumab. You're saying sacituzumab?
Who knows? Okay. I think it's sass.
So this was then looked at in the hormone-positive, HER2-negative setting in the TROPiCS-02 trial, which looked at patients with metastatic disease, sacituzumab govitecan versus clinician's choice of chemotherapy, which included capecitabine, vinorelbine, gemcitabine, and eribulin. And these patients had to have greater than or equal to two lines of chemotherapy in the metastatic setting. And this looked at 543 patients, and the primary outcome was progression-free survival, which was longer in the sacituzumab group, 5.5 months versus four months. So really only 1.5 month benefit in progression-free survival. The overall survival was recently published just in abstract form, and it was also longer in the sacituzumab group, 14.4 months versus 11.2 months. So about 3 month increase in overall survival. Again, this is only in abstract form, so we're waiting for the update in the full paper.
And just one last point for this trial. This also had a control, as we mentioned, of treatment of provider's choice. Slight differences between this and the previous mentioned trial. In this case, eribulin, capecitabine, gemcitabine, or vinorelbine was included, so no paclitaxel. But this might be because the patients had had more lines of chemotherapy between 2 and 4, and we'd assume most of them would have seen paclitaxel at some point. I think it's also worth mentioning that as we move into this new HER2-low era, I probably would not be using this medication in someone who's progressed on trastuzumab deruxtecan, because govitecan and deruxtecan are essentially the same active molecule. So I would presume there'd be some level of resistance.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how people choose or how people are using the trastuzumab deruxtecan and the sacituzumab govitecan in the hormone positive setting. I think in the triple negative setting right now, we have more data given that the TDXD trial, the Destiny Breast 04 only had 60 patients and were not included in the primary analysis. I think there's definitely more data for the sacituzumab govitecan, but it'll be interesting to see how these are sequenced going forward.
Yeah, I mean, we always have that mantra of no between trial comparisons, but I mean, the Destiny Breast patients seem to do so well, and there's a good argument for the mechanism behind the drug there that I would probably, in a HER2-low patient, reach for that first myself. Although I guess that would always depend on drug access and toxicity profile. Or if someone has already impaired lung function, I might be more likely to consider the sacituzumab, especially in patients who otherwise might be using trastuzumab deruxtecan.
Yeah, definitely. The TDXD is also only given once every 3 weeks, whereas sacituzumab you have to give 2 weeks on and 1 week off. So could be also something else to consider. Patients may not want to come in the 2 weeks in a row.
No, I think that's a really good point. I mean, we're talking about patients who are in kind of later stages of their disease, and treatment fatigue is a real thing. And the more time people are spending traveling to clinic, the more time they're receiving infusions, the less time they're actually able to enjoy that quality of life that we're trying to preserve. So not something unnecessary as a make or break decision, but certainly something to keep in mind when we're choosing our therapies. One of the many reasons why capecitabine is such a preferred agent. So we hope this was a helpful, quick discussion, and using the HER2 definitions, we're hoping to bridge that into our metastatic HER2-positive space and to discuss all the recent advents and management of this disease.
So thanks for listening, and we hope you stick with us. Next week, we'll be talking about... Probably 2 weeks. We'll be talking about the general management of HER2-positive breast cancer.
We appreciate your patience, and once again, any feedback at all, we welcome. We are doing this for your education and want this to be as useful as possible.
So happy new year, and we'll see you in 2023.
Bye for now.
For more information, follow us on Twitter at TalkingTumors, or feel free to email us at talkingabouttumors@gmail.com.
Please rate and review the podcast. We really appreciate it.
And special shout out to our friend John Kim for all of his musical talents.
And he's the composer of the music that you're hearing right now. Talking About Tumors is not medical advice.
For medical advice, please contact your own healthcare provider.
Opinions stated on this podcast are by the Ryan who said it and no one else. We have no financial disclosures, and this is done purely on our own time to the sake of our enjoyment of the field of medical oncology. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.